Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. And I'm very pleased to have on for the third time Michael Conley. And today we'll be discussing Mr. Conley's new book called Crime Beat, published by Little Brown, currently available in your bookstores. This book is a little bit different. And after, first of all, saying hello to Mr. Conley, we'll discuss what's a little bit different from this book than the other books that you've purchased from Michael Conley in the past. So first of all, Michael, thanks for taking time out of a busy schedule to talk with us again.
I'm glad to be back.
Crime Beat is a compilation of your journalism, and it was first collected by Stephen Vasek, if I'm pronouncing that right.
Vasek,
okay. And it was published on Crime Beat and Selected Journalism from 1984 through 1992. Now, the current book, which listeners can buy, is called Crime Beat, A Decade of Covering Cops and Killers, and is published by Little Brown. And I would like to mention that this will be in the true crime section of the bookstore. Some booksellers might put it in the fiction area next to Michael's other work, but others will have it in true crime. So just ask a bookseller where to find Crime Beat, and they'll point you in the right direction. So, Michael, first of all, I'd like to just find out a little bit about the genesis of this and why you decided to do the major release with Little Brown, which I'm very happy that you did. And if you would tell the listeners a little bit about the genesis of how this took place.
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting start to it. Stephen Vasek is a small publisher in Los Angeles who specializes in specialty limited editions, like with fancy leather covers and slip cases and so forth. But I think he looks around for other projects as well, and he got the idea for this book, basically, that he wanted to see some of the journalism I had done before I was a published author of novels. And so he started at the Los Angeles Times, where he knew I worked, and went into archives and just plugged my name in and drew up the hundreds and hundreds of stories I wrote as a police reporter, and started reading through them and started picking up what he called an echo, or a backwards echo, where he saw some stuff in some of the stories that he recognized from my books. And so he knew there was points of inspiration, either plot lines or little character moments. And so he started culling those out or printing those stories out. And then he eventually, and this probably took him quite a while, came to me with these printouts and said, I think people who like your work might be interested in these stories because there is a connection. And you can see the evolution of journalist to novelist and what he took forward with him. And so I had never really thought about that, and I said, okay, well, let me read this stuff first. And I took my time reading it, and there were these connections, and it wasn't like I was consciously doing it. That was the realization process I went through. It was, I guess, almost like a subconscious taking of ideas and nuances, and then there were some obvious plot things that were not so subconscious. And so that made me kind of a believer that, yeah, if you like reading about Harry Bosch, you might want to read some of these stories because you can see where he started. And then once it became something I was positive about, Stephen then went to the other paper I worked at for a number of years in South Florida and did the same thing. So the book is really a compilation of stories from both books. I mean, both newspapers.
Okay. And Michael, in the past when we've talked, you've told us that your heroes growing up were Raymond Chandler and Joseph Wambaugh, who was awarded the Grand Master at the Edgars in 2004. And he had quite an impact on you as a journalist and as a fiction writer. And as I was reading Crime Beat, I thought about some of the seminal work that he did in what we'll call creative nonfiction journalism, and he kind of paved the way and was one of your models as you began your career as a writer, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was very important to me in both, as you kind of mentioned, both fiction and nonfiction. He wrote about the world that I was interested in, obviously, and he jumped back and forth between novels and true stories like The Onion Field. And so it was very inspirational, and you mentioned Raymond Chandler. These guys were kind of forebearers of books, obviously though, beneath the umbrella of crime fiction. And between the both of them, my idea when I finally sat down and said I'm ready to try to write a novel was to combine them and create a character that would have aspects of both of these writers' works. It was, and so Harry Bosch, it sounds weird, is almost like if Chandler and Wambaugh got together and had a child, I wanted that child to be Harry Bosch. So there were aspects of the private eye, the outsider, and of course Wambaugh wrote about cops, so they were the insiders. But I you know, it came up with the idea of an outsider with an insider's job, and that's where Harry Bosch came.
And who would have ever guessed that Harry Bosch has a half-brother, Mickey Haller, who has become a popular character, and The Lincoln Lawyer will be available in a nice trade paperback edition in July. So perfect book for vacation, The Lincoln Lawyer, and we'll talk about that in a minute, Michael, about where you're going with Echo Park, the next Harry Bosch novel, and then what you're going to do with Mickey Haller down the road. But on Crime Beat, you have the book broken up into three parts: the cops, the killers, and the cases. And in the introduction, the first, you open and you say moments. It all comes down to moments. I've been watching the detectives for more than 30 years. And the first thing I have to ask you was that from Elvis Costello?
Yeah, there's also a book, I forget who wrote it, but there's a book called Watching the Detectives as well. But, yeah, Elvis Costello is a musician, songwriter, whose work I've enjoyed. I've seen him in concert several times. I was lucky enough to meet him once as well. So, yeah, I'm sure that was a direct influence.
Yeah, I read that line in that song, Watching the Detectives, jumped into my head, and I asked my wife if the same thing happened when she read it, and it did. So, but what I love about the introduction, Michael, that you write, is that it really does all come down to moments with you and your attention to detail. And Sergeant George Hunt, in the introduction, you describe how he took off his glasses and hooked the earpiece in his mouth, and over time, you describe the experience you had as a 16-year-old young man making a decision that changed the trajectory of your life. And the fact that Hunt took off his glasses and put them in his mouth indirectly led to your career as a novelist, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that a good novel is about character, and character is put together by stringing together, you know, telling details. It's not a description. It's detail. It's getting little pieces of nuances and actions and statements that open windows into people's lives. And the sergeant, you know, I had watched him as a reporter at crime scenes and murder scenes, and he would put the glasses in his mouth. And I later saw that on the earpiece of the glass was a deep groove cut into it by his teeth, and I realized how he was clenching his teeth, and I knew that said something about him. So all in one little detail, a window opens and you have a real sense of a person. And as a reporter, I knew that's what I should look for in my stories. And when I became a novelist, or started to write novels, write fiction, I also was aware that's what I needed to do, get the sergeant's glasses into everything I write.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, the structure of the book, which is part one, is the cops. One of the stories is it opens with the call about Walter Moody. And one of the things that I particularly enjoy about Crime Beat is you mentioned that the detectives don't have the need nor the time to stand and watch the post-mortem procedures like they do on the TV cop shows. And one of the things I think that Crime Beat and your time spent as a reporter is fascinating to me is you get a real feel for the daily grind that the detectives go through. They number the number of homicides they have in the city, and they're not standing around in the coroner's office and the cell phone rings 5 minutes later telling them they've got a tip.
Right. Yeah, I mean that was the purpose of that story, was to try to bring a reality to it. I think, and even so, I wrote that story, I think it came out in 87.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are all these years later. later, and television cop shows are more prevalent, and they have a tendency to shape the public's idea of how things are done. And they're not. The TV shows are entertainment first, and then they care about accuracy a second. And I'm not complaining about that. That's what TV's about. It's there to entertain you. But people, I think, also think it's informing them, and it's not always doing that. And one of the ideas of the story was to, say exactly how it is. And if it's boring, then the story's going to have parts that are boring. But it would at least be an accurate depiction of what one week in the life of a homicide squad is like. And I enjoyed it. You got to remember, at the same time, here's this guy has hopes, secret hopes, of becoming a crime novelist, and he gets his opportunity. And at that time, I was probably, like everyone else, informed by TV about how I think it works. And to have that kind of entree into the world, I wasn't bored. I was completely fascinated, even during what the detectives would consider the boring work. And so it was a great story for me to get assigned to. It's the first story in this book, and it's positioned there for a purpose, and that's because it's probably the most important story I ever wrote in terms of my evolution as a novelist. The thing was published 17 years ago. I've written 16 books since then, but every one of those books and the books I'll write in the future, I'm still mining that one week I had with the cops, because that was the best immersion into that world I've ever had and probably will ever get.
Mm-hmm. And, Michael, in the introduction you talk about sometimes the killers called you, and you say that Jonathan Lund was the creepiest killer that you ever crossed paths with. And if you would, I found that fascinating, that, number one, that the killers would call you, and, number two, what it was that made him creepier than the rest. Just, I mean, you don't have to go into depth in it, but just... how often did they call you?
Well, it's interesting. The inmates in the jails, prisons, have access to phones, and papers or newspapers are circulated around, and there's your name on these stories. So it would happen quite often that someone would call you. And, of course, most of the time they're calling to say, I didn't do this. Can you do investigative reporting and clear me? And the percentages of people that are actually innocent and in there, I think, is small. But if you went by the phone calls you get, everybody in jail is innocent.
Of course.
But in a way, it becomes a nuisance. In the early part of my days as a reporter, there was no such thing as caller ID, and you just answer it, your phone would ring, you say hello. It got to a point that you would say, like, L.A. County Jail, when technology got better. And I have to say, I didn't even take all the calls. There were always so many, because I didn't have the time. I was working on stories, and I was doing other things, and I knew that the chances were 80% that it was going to be someone else wanting me to look into their case because they're innocent, or wanting to take issue with a story I wrote about them being arrested or so forth. So I couldn't talk to all of them. But there was no shortage of those kind of calls. In regard to Jonathan Lund, he was charged with one murder, but the police, the detectives who were on the case and I knew and spoke to were, you could tell they were on their best game on this case because they were concerned and probably suspicious that there were other victims, that this guy might have been a serial killer, but they weren't sure, and it didn't matter if they were sure or not. There was not enough evidence to go to trial with him other than the one sex slaying that they did have evidence on. So they were going as hard as they could to make sure this guy, the case was good, and that they would get a guilty verdict. And Lund was trying to think of a good description, kind of a slippery, clever guy. He convinced the judge to let him be his own attorney by telling him he'd gone to law school but just hadn't finished. And when I did my research as a reporter, I found that was a lie, that he had never gone to school to learn forth, but by becoming his own attorney, his access to phones and so forth in the jail was increased, because he was supposed to be able to call witnesses and so on and so forth. So he called me quite a bit. And because it was a capital murder case, and because it was a case I was very interested in, I always took those calls. And so we had some conversations over a several-month period. And, you know, he was eventually found guilty and sentenced to life without parole. And it's just kind of a creep. There's a building creep factor to know this guy you've been talking to had been involved in a very heinous murder, and now he's kind of gone from society forever.
That's interesting. And as you were just talking there, I was thinking of for the fans of your other work, particularly Harry Bosch. As you were talking, I was thinking of the Lincoln Lawyer, of Mickey Haller, how he advertises, and people in the jail can see his bonding or his phone number of one of the bonding agents, and how they screen those. And it also kind of resonated a little bit with a character in the Lincoln Lawyer in terms of being a pretty slick operator.
Yeah. I mean, that's like one of those echoes. I mean, I think when I was writing about the guy in Lincoln Lawyer, I was thinking about, and he was making his protest of innocence, I think I was certainly thinking about people like Jonathan Lund, who are able to convince a lot of people by what they say.
Yeah, and cell phones are now considered like currency in prisons, I understand.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They're smuggled in or something?
Yeah, they're smuggled in, and then people are using them kind of like contraband, like they used to with cigarettes and stuff. Michael, in part two, The Killers, America's Most Wanted, you write about Toru Saki, about a Tarzana man that was held in the murder of his father. And if you would, what I like about that piece is that as a reader, we get to follow along as you're writing some of the columns. And then tell us how that ultimately ended.
Well, Toru was a guy who was accused of killing his father. His parents were getting divorced. There was a lot of money involved, and he thought he and his mother were going to be cut out of the money. So he used a high school friend and sort of ambushed his father. And it was a difficult case for the police piecing it together, and they didn't really have the evidence to do anything until the high school friend, they got the goods on him, and he decided to cooperate and say how the murder took place. Unfortunately, by the time, and he made a deal, you know, he would not be prosecuted if he told them how Toru set this up, and they accomplished it. Unfortunately, by the time this happened, Toru had slipped away and disappeared, and now all these years later, he's still charged with his father's murder, but they don't know where he is, so he's never been brought to justice. I mean, I think there's a bit of a theme in the book, Crime Beat. There's a lot of cases in there that are unresolved, either by arrest or even knowing who killed the victim. There's a lot of irony in the book. What I mean by that is justice not being served, or the justice system being its own worst enemy, not being able to get out of its way, in fact. And so I think that is one of those senses, if you read this book in whole, that's one of the things that you'll say, or I hope you will say at the end, well, this is just like his books.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, Michael, I agree wholeheartedly with what you just said, and one of the things that as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, how much money is being spent with defense attorneys and prosecutors and police man hours tracking down these killers? And in one of the cases that you write about involving a crack dealer, the number of defense attorneys that were being paid by the city was astronomical.
Yeah, that was a case where, like, the it became too big and unwieldy to even handle. The justice system couldn't swallow this case. It got so big, and it was, you know, it began of good intentions, the taking down of the complete hierarchy of a drug organization, a street drug organization, and it was just, I th- think when they were finally ready to go to trial, they had like 14 or 15 defendants, and they all had to have their own lawyers, and they were all claiming they were indigent, so the city was paying the bill. And it was shaping up that it would be the longest trial ever, the most expensive trial ever, in terms of the state of California. And we've had some big famous cases, you know, but this was going to be the most expensive trial ever mounted. And then finally, saner heads prevailed, or cooler heads prevailed, and they kind of broke it up and had two or three trials, I believe, in the end. And I think they came to that precipice of saying, you know, we have finally hit a place where the justice system cannot handle a case like this.
And that's what makes I think Crime Beat so one of the things that makes it so interesting. And as the evolution of Harry Bosch evolves, there's a word that Ruth Francisco used in one of her novels, and it's called acedia, and the monks call it the noonday demon. And as I was reading this, I almost physically got tired at times as the homicide detectives would finally settle into their easy chairs at the end of the day and the call comes. And if you would just mention that physical and emotional exhaustion that they go through.
Well, that was, I'm glad you picked up on that. That was one of the key things I wanted to get into the books, about how it's a job that never really ends, and you have scenes of cops working all day, detectives working all day on a case, and finally hitting a level of exhaustion and going home, and one guy falls asleep in his chair watching a baseball game, and he's jerked out of it by his pager, and they have the quote unquote the call. There's another homicide, and you know he can't go back to sleep. He has to hit the road again, and there's an irony in that story. We're back to the first story that we talked about before of the week with the homicide squad. There were three killings in that week, so it was a very busy week. And to me, the irony is, I've talked about what a great story this was and what an important story it was for me. And what made it important and great for me was the death of three people. And that kind of underlines the strangeness of the world of a reporter and, but more so, the world of a homicide detective. You know, in the LAPD, they wear T-shirts. The homicide squad people have T-shirts that say, "Our day begins when your day ends."
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the same way for a reporter. Our best stories are about the worst things that can happen, about murders, interesting murders, plane crashes, things like that. What gets a reporter's adrenaline going is usually something bad that has happened.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, if you would, tell us a bit, the show originates in Columbus, Ohio, you're in California, and tell us, if you would, a bit about what's going on in your life right now, because we talked about it briefly before the interview, and I think that your readers would find it of interest.
Well, I'm in California right now for a couple reasons, but this very day I'm out here to see a very close friend of mine who's not doing that well, and you know, some of the readers might even be aware of him. His name's Terry Hansen. My book, Blood Work, was dedicated to him and inspired by him. He was a friend of mine who had the heart transplant, and the year of my life when I was close with him as he waited to hear whether he was getting a heart, and then he got it, and to go through the surgery and the recovery period, we were very close at that point. I spent a lot of time with him. And from there was where the idea for the book Blood Work came from. And there's a, I don't know what to say, like a bittersweet feeling about this. The guy was the benefactor of one of our modern medical miracles. He certainly wouldn't be around now if he had not been able to get the second chance through a new heart. And he's far outreached the projections, the average extension of life from a heart transplant is like 5 years, and he's going on 14, and so all that's good, but he's a good friend. friend. He's not doing that well, so I want to be out here, you know, to tell him to hang in there.
Yeah, good. Raymond Carver wrote a poem one time called Gravy about the length of his life after he had diagnosed with an illness. And I know that must be difficult for you, and I send our thoughts and prayers along to him and his family. Michael, we mentioned that the Lincoln Lawyer is coming out in paperback in July, and then Echo Park, I believe it's October, is the publication date for the next Terry Bosch, correct?
Yeah, that's working on that now, just doing the copy editing, and that will be good to go pretty soon.
And then the last time we talked about the Lincoln Lawyer, you were talking about Mickey Haller and Harry meeting at some point in time. Has that happened yet, or is that, because I know you mentioned that the last novel you started Echo Park, you had kind of thought that was might happen there, but it ended up becoming a Harry Bosch novel.
What it was is my realization that I if I'm going to bring these two characters together, it should be a pretty significant story. Not bring them together because people think it would be cool, or because it's I'm working off of the success of Lincoln Lawyer. I kind of pulled back. I was going to have both of them in Echo Park, and I took Mickey Haller out of that story. Although I think it's a good book and a significant book on its own, the case or the reason that these two would be together was not worthy, basically. And so I want to wait. I planted the seed in the Lincoln Lawyer that these two guys are related, unbeknownst to one another, and that will be something I'll explore in a future book. I think I'm coming close to doing it. I don't know if it will be the next thing I write, but I think it will either be the next thing I write or the one after that, because I'm finally getting to the point where I think I have a good way of getting into that story and exploring their relationship.
Good. And Michael, I really appreciate your time, because I know your the time demands on your schedule are very great. And I would just like to ask you, for the writers out there, your success has become is worldwide, and the compression of time for you must be fairly difficult to actually write your new novels while you're doing promotions like this one and doing book tours. And how has your life changed, or what adaptations have you had to make so that you can actually get the writing done at the level that you want it done at, and not fall into the trap that others have fallen into, which is cranking out work, which you have never done, and I know you never will? How do you do that?
Well, it's hard, and it's also part mystery, that I can't really say right off the bat this is why it hasn't happened, or hopefully hasn't happened. I do know that I have a gene or something that drives me not to let it happen. You know, I am by far the most difficult critic of my work. You know, once a book has gone through my own criticism, nothing the New York Times or anybody else could say can approach the level that I hold my work up to. And I try not to ever relax that, no matter what the circumstances. I mean, I think it would be easy to say, well, this book will work. I had a tough year of travel, and, you know, this is the best I could do under those circumstances. I just don't allow myself to think that way. Whatever we do in life, whether we're an interviewer, whether we're a writer, whether we build houses, whether we're a doctor, surgeon, whatever, you get better at it. You should get better at it. And I hold that standard to myself. I can't make any steps back. I mean, I'm very lucky to be in the position I'm in, to have the success I have, and it's just ridiculous to ever take a step back from that. I should get better every time out. And a lot of it is nuance. A lot of people can't tell where I've gotten better, but when you remember I say I'm my most difficult critic, my most harshest critic, I know where I've gotten better or where I can get better, and I work at it.
Good. Well, Michael, thank you again for the time, and how about we'll kind of pencil in for the listeners when Echo Park comes out. We'll have you back on the show, and we'll talk about what Harry Bosch is up to in the new novel.
That would be good. I think it'd be a little, some surprises in what Harry's up to, so I think it might be worth talking about.
Great. Michael, as always, thanks for your time, continued success, and thank you for the great stories.
Thanks, Katie.